Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Still Laughing, A Life in Comedy, from the creator of Laugh-In, by George Schlatter with John Max, forward by Lily Tomlin, afterward by Goldie Hawn, narrated by P.J. Oakland. Forward by Lily Tomlin. I never thought that television was right for me. I had two chances, and I failed at both. I was in California to do a TV show that had been canceled mid-season, so I was preparing myself to go back to New York because the theater was there. I had planned to make a life in the theater, but I did not get very far. On the plus side, nobody really knew about me yet, so I thought there was still a chance. My agent and my manager kept begging me before I left Los Angeles to take one last meeting with this producer. Well, I didn't want to meet any more producers. I mean, did I really want to do one of my characters while sitting across from them at their desk, watching them shrink back in their chair with a look of, "What is this?" on their face? I'd been there too many times, and I knew how it always played out. Just a few minutes into the meeting, the producer's phone would ring, and their secretary would usher me out of the room. Outside on the street, I'd slip into a phone booth, sobbing at the rejection and the humiliation. I'd call my agent. He'd say, "Lily, what did you do? They said they never want you back again." My reputation was being ruined before I even had one. But of course, I hadn't planned on meeting George Schlatter. As soon as I saw him, I knew I was in the right place. He was a happy, big bear of a guy who might as well have thrown his arms around me as soon as I walked in. He appreciated every character I showed him. He laughed, he gave me confidence, and most importantly, he hired me. So suddenly, I was on Laugh-In, and my life changed. George changed my life, overnight, literally. Well, first he changed Ernestine's life. She aired on Monday night. On Tuesday, Ernestine was a star. She was a bona fide star. People stopped me everywhere. At a light, people would actually jump out of their cars. People pushing a cart in the market or walking on the beach would say, "You're that new girl." I'm laughing demurely and saying in agreement, "I guess so." And then they'd say, "The girl who does Ernestine, that phone operator. She's a riot." I'd say, "I do Ernestine, I'm the one who does the phone operator." And then they'd drive away or walk away or swim away, as if they weren't really sure that I was telling the truth. I've had a career ever since George had me sit down at that switchboard. He gave me a career, a huge career, just as he's given careers to so many others. And all the people he's helped, all the laughs he's given us over the decades, are in the stories in this wonderful book. George brings to life all the people you can see in those iconic photos on the walls in his office. But they're not just images on photographic paper. They're all George's friends. Real people whose names happen to be Frank and Judy and Sammy and Dean and Lily and Goldie and Artie and Ruth and Joanne. The humanity and humor that George brought out in them is reflected in every story in these chapters. And now it's time for you to begin listening to Still Laughing, A Life in Comedy. And be prepared, you're about to enter the world of a legend, George Schlatter. Preface. Ode to Jolene. With a few notes about the writing of this book. Ode. Something that shows respect for or celebrates the worth or influence of another. Jolene Brand Schlatter. How I got her, I don't know. She was a dark-haired, classic beauty, winning contests and working as a model. Her photo was on many Capitol Records albums, including the famous George Shearing Black Satin album and the Calypso album by Robert Mitchum. As you will hear later, we met when she became the lead dancer at Ciro's on the Sunset Strip. Jolene was such a favorite of celebrities like writers Harrison Carroll and columnists Luella Parsons and Army Archer that she was featured with her name on the Ciro's billboard out front on Sunset Boulevard, despite the fact that she wasn't that good as a dancer. Jolene was an accomplished actress appearing on many television shows. For several years, she modeled on Queen for a Day. She appeared as Anna Maria, Zorro's love interest on Disney's Zorro series, and as Pink Cloud on Desilu's Guestward Ho. During her run on the Ernie Kovacs show, often as part of the Nairobi Trio and the Girl in the Bathtub, Jolene developed a love of sight gags, and it was she who came up with the catchphrase, "Sock it to me for laughing." This lovely lady gave up a flourishing career to marry me. She got me out of checkered jackets and white patent leather shoes. She smoothed off the rough edges and made me acceptable in an important, influential circle, which enhanced my career. But most importantly, Jolene got me out of Vegas. That story is in the book. Jolene became involved with charities in Hollywood. She was one of the early members of Cher, which was founded by a group of Hollywood wives, including Jean, Mrs. Dean Martin, Ginny, Mrs. Henry Mancini, Mrs. Jeff Chandler, Audrey, Mrs. Billy Wilder, Janet Lee, and Neil, Mrs. Steve McQueen. Cher's annual Boomtown party was the most sought-after ticket in town and raised thousands of dollars for children's charities. Today, she is very supportive of Homes for Our Troops, which builds specially adapted custom homes for severely injured post-9/11 and later veterans. We have now been married 67 years and have two wonderful daughters. Our daughter Maria won an Emmy for producing the Frank Sinatra birthday special and a celebration of Sammy Davis Jr. She also won an Emmy for producing and writing a Dolly Parton Christmas special. Our daughter AJ and her husband Kevin own a ranch in Arizona where they breed horses and train young equestrians. They also own a prize-winning Samoyed named Huxton. Some of Jolene's many other accomplishments and adventures are told in the stories in this book, but I just wanted to publicly thank my girlfriend, roommate, and wife, who saw something in me that I didn't, and our partnership got me where I am today. I want everyone to know how much this woman means to me. And now for those notes. Still laughing. It has so many different meanings. Yes, I created Laughin', and 50 years after it went off the air, it is still considered one of the most influential series in the history of comedy. Laughin' launched the careers of legends like Goldie Hawn, created catchphrases like "Sock it to me," rose to become the number one show on television, and probably elected President Nixon. I am so sorry about that last one. More on that later. And me? I'm 93 and still laughing. Which is a lot better than the alternative. Years ago, I did an interview where I said I was born in 1932 instead of telling the truth that I was born in 1929. So many people think I just turned 90 when in fact I'm 93. I feel bad and apologize. I should have told a bigger lie and said I was born in 1942. Anyway, this is my story. A story of a kid from Missouri who ended up working with some of the most fascinating people in the history of show business. Before I take that long dirt nap, I want to share with you the laughs I've had with them, the lies I've told, the events I instigated, which is a classier way of saying the shit I started, and the laws I may have broken. Somehow, for over half a century, whether as their friend, producer, or drinking buddy, I ended up being in the room, in bars, in planes, backstage, and in casinos, with the legends of TV, music, and movies. I could not write this book the way so many of the other career books have been written, where it traces a person's life and career in a strict chronological and very linear manner. My life's best moments come to me in brief episodes where one thing reminds me of something else, where a story about one person makes me think of someone else. It's not logical, but then again, nothing in my career has been logical. The best I could do is to organize by sections. The reason for doing it this way is that when I look back at my life, the things that I remember most vividly are almost always funny moments, people, and experiences. I believe that the human mind does not have the power to retain the sensation of pain. At least mine doesn't. So the focus of this book will always be the people I've worked with and show business moments and stories that have made me laugh or made other people laugh. Some sections will be long and may meander all over the place, while others will be really short. Some people you might recognize will only have brief cameos. Others will feature as recurring characters. Some will have me as a supporting actor, others as the lead. And the best part? Almost all of what follows is true. In this book, I'd like to take you back with me to a world of show business that doesn't exist anymore, but will never be forgotten. For it is the foundation on which today's television was built. And my wish is simple. That in the end, when you finish this memoir, you too will still be laughing. Part 1. In the Beginning. Growing up. Although some may say that a 93-year-old who still loves fart jokes never really grew up, my story does go back a ways. I was born in Birmingham, Alabama. All the nurses were somewhat in awe because they say I was born with a perfect veil. A veil is a kind of thin membrane that certain babies have that covers their head. In the South, it is quite a superstitious symbol in voodoo. It is supposed to denote a person with magical powers of perception who is able to see into the future. Obviously, it was bullshit, because at my age, I can't even see someone standing 10 feet away from me. Anyhow, shortly after they removed my veil, which if I could see the future I could have predicted they would do, we left Birmingham and moved around all over the country. Indianapolis, Detroit, Peoria, Jacksonville, and eventually we ended up in a small town called East Aurora in New York. East Aurora was so small there was no West Aurora. My father was a salesman and we lived at the Roycroft Inn, which was built by Elbert Hubbard, who was quite a renowned individual back in the 1800s. I guess it didn't take much to be renowned in East Aurora. Having grown up moving constantly, it's not strange that I would continue moving as a young man. In this section, I'll share a bit about my early years, about Vegas, and how I got out of Vegas alive. I will certainly tell you about the incident with me and the amorous chimps, bet that got your attention, and how amorous George met gorgeous Jolene. My world premiere. East Aurora is 18 miles outside of Buffalo, which was what I liked best about it. Our backyard had a railroad track right behind it, and I can remember hearing those railroad cars going by and counting them until I went to sleep. The railroad is important. It was the site of my first money-making scheme. At night, we would go out and tape pennies to the track. The train would flatten them, and the next day I'd sell each flat penny for a nickel. Some suckers thought a flattened penny was a treasure. I just knew the value of a nickel. Doing that to money in many ways determined my career path. Driven by such impulses, either you become creative and likely end up in show business, or you keep up your illegal money-making schemes and end up as Bernie Madoff. My mother was a concert violinist with a wicked sense of humor. One of my earliest recollections of music was sitting in the first row when my mom was playing a violin solo in front of a huge orchestra. She had me sit there so she could keep an eye on me. Even then, I knew she was really good. But what I remember most was looking up and for the first time realizing that my mom had great legs. How about that? 9 years old and perving on my own mom's legs. Between my early love for music and legs, I was clearly headed to a life in show business. Eventually, my father bought a farm on Oleander Road outside of East Aurora. Now that is rural. We lived with my mom's mom, Mamie, who was a real character, and her sister Eileen and Eileen's daughter on a farm that had a wood stove and a well. We pumped for water and we had chickens, which is better than the other way around. There is no doubt this had an impact on my career. I always made sure laughing, always had chicken jokes. My father said for our allowance we could keep anything we made off the farm. So we raised a lot of corn, picked it, and then walked all the way down the road to try to sell it to farmers who didn't grow corn. If I couldn't get a reasonable price from the first guy, I had to walk all the way back and down to the other end of the road to see if I could sell it to the other guy. That little adventure was where I first learned to negotiate. Those farmers may have had cow shit on their shoes, but they were smart as hell. 10 cents for a dozen ears of corn doesn't sound like much today. It didn't sound like much back then either, so eventually I let my brothers handle the corn business. My first adventure in show business was in 7th grade. I was playing the giant in Jack and the Beanstalk. My big line was fee, fi, fo, fum. I had to sit on top of a big stepladder for most of the play, and then I had to come down the stepladder carrying a chicken. By the time I got there, my green felt costume was covered with chicken shit. Good practice for a life in show business, as it got me prepared for reading TV critics' reviews. In grade school, I learned to play first clarinet and then sax, but I wasn't thrilled with either. I was the only kid in school who still had a steel clarinet, while all the other kids had wood clarinets, so I took up the sax. The cheapest instrument at the music store was a C melody sax. Any musician can tell you there is nothing written for the C melody sax, so whatever I was playing bore no resemblance to what the rest of the orchestra was playing. Let's just say the concert musician gene did not pass down from my mother to me. Eventually, my dad was transferred by the Magic Chef Stove Company to St. Louis, and we ended up in Webster Groves, Missouri, which is where I went to high school. I was captain of the wrestling team and the football team, but after I had polio, which weakened me for a while and scared off recruiters, I couldn't get into a big football college, so I got a scholarship to a little school in Marshall called Missouri Valley College, which had a legendary football program. 42 games without a tie or defeat. Nobody wanted to play us because most members of our team were ex-Marines. Some had even been in prison camps. One of the blocking backs had one arm. Another defensive lineman had one eye. He had lost the other one in a German prison camp. A bunch of grown, bearded, mean men who had just gotten out of the Marines and who came back to this little Midwestern school on the GI Bill, and me. Our team, think of a squad of Marines on Liberty, would go out on weekends and get drunk and throw hip blocks on small trees. Our helmets and jerseys didn't match when we started out, but the town made so much money off this football team, after one season we became the best-dressed bunch of foul-mouthed, tobacco-spitting, cigar-sucking, rebel-yelling, beer-drinking, womanizing, practical joking athletes in the Midwest. I was the littlest guy on the team. I weighed about 175 pounds, and the rest of the team averaged about 230. The good news was that training on beer apparently adds weight. And as the new guy, I'll admit I was the victim of some hazing. My ex-Marine teammates took my mattress and tied it with ropes to the rear of a Model T Ford and dragged it around in the snow just for laughs. It was frozen solid for 2 days. Another morning, I woke up with my bed balanced on top of some lockers. I must have been a sound sleeper or really hungover. Everyone thought that was funny. Today, I agree it was funny. I was in pain most of the time from being pounded by these larger animals, but I wound up playing second string on this college team in my freshman year, right up until I got mononucleosis and got shut down for the season. I was a tough kid, but not indestructible. Although over the years I survived, which proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that alcohol is a preservative. During the summer after that first year in college, I performed with the St. Louis Municipal Opera. The amphitheater seated 14,000 people, and it was the model for all the outdoor theaters that now exist. On lunch breaks and between shows, I ran down to the Grand Theater to check out one of its 5 burlesque shows a day. I loved everything about burlesque. Later I'll tell you how I turned it into a TV special, but for me the best part was watching the comics. Legends in their day like Tommy Moe Raft, Billy Zoot Reed, Bell Barth, B.S. Pulley, Sparky Kaye, and Hank Henry. I learned what shtick meant from the very best, which was useful when I ended up in Hollywood. How I got from Missouri to Hollywood. At the end of that summer with the opera, I came to California to go on tour with the roadshow of The Desert Song, and I promptly got a throat infection. A singer with a throat infection is like a field goal kicker with a broken foot. So, showing the compassion that most people in the field of entertainment had back then, the roadshow left without me. I was stranded with no money, no job, no throat, and no scholarship. At that moment, I was getting ready to begin my penny-flattening scheme again. Instead, I took 3 of those precious pennies, bought a 3-cent stamp, and wrote to the coach at my former college in Missouri. 1 letter from him, and George Pepperdine College gave me a football scholarship, sight unseen. Pepperdine had been offered a chance to play Missouri Valley College in the Junior Rose Bowl, but nobody would play Missouri Valley. The Pepperdine coach thought if I was good enough to make the Missouri Valley team as a freshman, I'd be good enough for Pepperdine. Today, Pepperdine has a magnificent campus in Malibu, the mountains on one side, the Pacific on the other. Back then, it was in downtown L.A. on Vermont Avenue, overlooking, as I recall, a bar, a cemetery, and car dealership. Pepperdine and I proved to be an awkward match. It was a Church of Christ school with 2 mandatory chapel sessions a day. Talk about culture shock. Missouri Valley had 2 mandatory beer-chugging sessions a day. The powers in charge at Pepperdine were so strict, they did not want the students getting laid because it could lead to dancing. That's an old joke, but in many ways, so am I. My not-so-distant past, however, came back to haunt me. When I was in Missouri, I would go to Kansas City and fight in the American Legion Hall. If you won, you got a radio. If you didn't win, you got bus fare. But even if you did win, you couldn't keep the radio. You sold it back for $25. The radio had about 1 inch of dust on it. There were some gangsters who ran the fights there, and you had to always give the radio back. Although they gave you a choice. You could keep the radio and lose your thumb, or keep your thumb and give back the radio. In Missouri, they considered that amateur, but not at Pepperdine. I was the Jim Thorpe of Pepperdine, busted for my professional status. One of the guys I had boxed with remembered my name and that I had gotten some money to fight, and so the school canceled my scholarship. Much later, when I became famous, they put me back on the alumni list. Fame and a check helped a lot. Now, while I was attending classes and chapel, I was also dating this little blonde singer by the name of Monty Fraser. She had the voice of an angel and a body to die for. She appeared on Ada Leonard's show, Search for Girls, which was an early version of Star Search, and every 13 weeks they would have the finals. This girl was terrific and won 10 weeks in a row. At some point, we agreed that along with the privilege of dating her, I could also become her manager. The writer of the show was a young man, and we became friendly. At one point, he came to me and asked if Monty would agree not to compete for the next few weeks. Otherwise, they couldn't do the finals, since she had been the only winner they had in that cycle. I stupidly agreed, but instead I should have made a long-term management deal on behalf of Monty. Even so, he wanted me to manage him, too, but I told him I only had room for one client, and that was my little blonde singer. He asked me how I made a living, and I said, "Well, every week of the contest, she wins a dress. After the show, we sell the dress and we split the money." He was not impressed. Nevertheless, he tried to convince me to sign him. I knew, of course, he had no future. The writer's name was Aaron Spelling. If I had stayed with Aaron instead of the blonde, by now I would have 70 shows on the air and own a 12-acre lot in Beverly Hills with a 3-acre house on it. This might have been the first of many bad decisions I have made along the way. To try to make ends meet, I worked as a tree trimmer, a bricklayer, a cement finisher, a carpenter, and a truck driver. All that led up to me getting a new suit, which in turn led to how the newly suited George Schlatter ended up in show business. I become an agent. Stay with me on this one. I feel a veering coming on. It was 1948. I had read a story in the paper about MCA, the gigantic theatrical agency then known as the Music Corporation of America. It sounded interesting, so I applied for a job, groveling my way into a very low-paying gig in the mailroom, word on the street being that everyone who was anyone had spent some time in the MCA mailroom. I was wearing a gray gabardine suit with a dignified tie, oxblood shoes, and argyle socks. I may have been the only one there not wearing a black mohair suit and black shoes, and stood out like a Republican at the NAACP convention, like a hooker at a convent, like Kanye at a B'nai B'rith meeting. And that, everyone, is the rule of three. I had been summoned to meet my new boss in the big office at the end of the hall. His name was Larry Barnett. He was big, bald, and bombastic, with a body temperature of a glacier. His personality could prevent global warming. I went into his office and stood there, waiting for Mr. Barnett to get off the phone, when a shock wave of energy went through the building. Frank Sinatra had arrived unannounced. He strode into Barnett's office, followed by everyone in the MCA band and act department. I shouldn't have been there, but there was no place to hide, so I just stood right where I was, with my mouth open. Mr. Sinatra said to Mr. Barnett, "Give me the papers." Mr. Barnett gave Mr. Sinatra the papers. Mr. Sinatra then asked, "Has the fat man read this?" He was referring to his lawyer, Mickey Rudin, a.k.a. the Fat Man. Barnett nodded yes. "Okay, it's the same deal as before, right?" When Barnett meekly nodded yes, Sinatra signed 3 copies of what I was soon to learn was the MCA management contract. But this contract was different from every other MCA management contract. The big, big difference.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?